WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Fogerty is back with us. This time he's brought his guitar. In June, we talked about his years with Creedence Clearwater Revival. Between 1968 and 72, the year Creedence broke up, they had several gold records as well as 8 top 10 singles, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Down on the Corner, and Looking Out My Back Door. Fogerty has a new CD called Premonition, which is a live recording of a VH1 concert featuring many old Creedence songs. We played several tracks from it during his last visit. This time, we asked him to perform some of the songs he first recorded on his 1997 album, Blue Moon Swamp. John Fogerty, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here in person with your guitar. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
I'd really like to highlight some of the songs that you've written since the Creedence Clearwater days. So maybe we could start with a song that you did on your CD from last year, which is the CD that won the Record of the Year in the Grammys. And
actually, it was Rock Album.
Rock Album of the Year. Excuse me.
Don't
the categories get so confusing.
Don't
want to
take
now.
Anything away from Mr. Dylan.
That's right. Correct. It was Rock Album of the Year. So this is called Blue Moon Nights. Would you say something about the song and writing it before you do it for us?
This song is very reflective of a certain style. I'm searching for the word and I can't find it right now. A niche in American music that was really carved out by Sun Records and Sam Phillips and all the great artists that he had there in his little studio in Memphis. That music, those records, had a really big impact on me. Happily, it was a good thing to be influenced by. You know, that's not always the case, but those records made under, let's say, very economical conditions are still some of the best music that I can relate to in my own influences or upbringing. And what Blue Moon Nights was a guy in the 90s writing or pretending, kind of the way a novelist does. He throws himself into a different era, kind of like writing a historical novel or something. And I tried to write a song that would have fit very well into the middle 50s Sun era, a lot of acoustic sound, kind of always had that sort of haunting, plaintive sound to them, real simple instrumentation. And that's where I was going with this. It's the kind of, a lot of the Sun songs you can sit at home alone with an acoustic guitar and play, and that's what this is.
Help me, fellas, I'm feeling kind of weak. The way I'm living just ain't right. I need somebody to watch over me all my blue moon night. Want a girl to take me by the hand, follow me right down the line. Hold me gently while we dance all my blue moon night. Heaven only knows I don't wanna be just a fool passing through. I want you send an angel to walk with me all my blue moon night, all my blue moon. Oh, my blue moon night.
John Fogerty is my guest. Tell me more about when you first heard those Sun recordings that influenced the song that we just heard.
How can I say it? I had been musical from a very early age, meaning I think it was showing up in me at the age of 2 or 3. But when Sun Records came along, or those songs, it clearly reverberated in me. And I mean, when I sit down with a guitar, acoustic guitar, and play an E chord, I can't help but think of Elvis and Carl Perkins.
Wait, why an E chord? Play an E chord and tell me why an E chord.
That, you know, it's just that.
train, train, coming down, down the line.
Elvis Presley certainly, how can I say it? He defined what a rock and roll band is, a rhythm guitar, a lead guitar, a bass and drums, and a wild singer. I mean,
how did he affect your voice?
Actually, he didn't at first because I was 11 years old. He affected what it looked like. I can remember standing in front of a mirror with a broom, you know, because I'd seen Elvis on probably the Dorsey show, and that, you know, and wiggling his lip and like that. Well, I couldn't play the guitar yet, but I saw on television he was raising his lip. Now, he raised the left side of his mouth, but I was seeing him on TV, and it came out in the mirror when I saw myself. I learned to do it on the right side. I learned the lip part before I learned the guitar.
It sounds like your voice hadn't even changed yet.
No, it was a pretty funny sight to see a kid singing kind of like a Vienna boys choir guy with a broom, you know, trying to do Hound Dog or something. It's pretty comical, really.
Now, what about the sound of the reverb on those Sun Sessions? Did that affect you when you started to make your own records and you were going after a certain sound?
Yeah, I have always called that Sun Echo. Later, I learned that people would call it things like tape echo or slapback echo. And what it really is not a big reverberation chamber like a gymnasium or a large bathroom or a stairwell in a, you know, bank building. It's actually repeating. You know, the sound would hit and then the tape would roll past the next head on the machine and it would come back. So you got this kind of sound. And Sam very cleverly, you know, moved the instruments around in the room and the singer to the point where certain things would be more affected by the tape echo than other things. In other words, he was throwing tape echo on everything. The whole record had it. And it was, no one has matched that yet, how Sam did it. No one has made records that sound that way. I know I have tried. I've heard a lot of other, let's say, pseudo rock and roll records where they give you the illusion, but it doesn't have that same magic that the old Sun Records had because it was used very artfully.
My guest is John Fogerty, and he has a new CD called Premonition, in which he does a lot of his old Creedence Clearwater Revival songs, songs which he hadn't performed for many years. And his album right before that, Blue Moon Swamp, won the Best Rock Album of the Year Grammy Award back in 1997. And I'd like to ask you to do a song that's on both of those CDs, and it's called Joy of My Life. And this is, song is almost a little out of character for you. I don't think of you as specializing in love ballads. so tell me a little bit about this song and about writing it.
You're right. I'm a guy that was bitten by the rock and roll bug, and I'm also male and sort of a rambunctious boy, actually. So I always sort of adopted the stance that rock and roll ought to be, you know, loud and feisty, and without realizing it, I was very male, almost to the extent of being macho in my approach. And just as a fan of the music, I usually, say, writing in the car, if a sappy love song came on the radio, I would hit that button immediately. Not that I'm without those feelings, but I had a lot of trouble, let's say, expressing feelings of love or tenderness. And certainly musically, I mean, I'd go, oh, gee, don't touch me with that stuff. And so I literally did not write love songs after the age of about 16, when at that time, that's all I wrote. It's a funny thing in music. I had no idea what I was talking about at 16. I was just rhyming words. I mean, you know, that's what you learn from the radio, a bunch of words that rhyme, like moon and June and, oh, when will I see you? I miss you, and all that kind of teenage angst stuff, without really knowing what you're talking about. I hadn't experienced a lot of the stuff that was in the music. So I went off and had a successful career, you know, sort of full of a lot of storytelling, but not a lot of feelings of the heart being expressed. Anyway, much later in life, much more recently, I met my darling wife, Julie, and for the first time really in my life, I think because of her relationship with the universe, number one, obviously she's female, but she's also very in touch with her feelings, and feelings are important to her. I mean, this is the most wonderful thing that happened to me. I can unashamedly say that I probably wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for Julie.
So this song is for her?
Absolutely. About 3, 4, 5 years into our relationship, I began to feel like I wanted to write a love song to her. But I'd never done it before, and this is sort of Spartacus being revisited or something, you know. I knew I had to really do it right. It couldn't just be a first attempt like when you're 11. It had to be really good if I was going to record it. So I went through a lot of extra agony trying to get it right because I wanted to talk or express myself in the song the way I really talked to her, not some highfalutin Broadway show tune that's really general and generic, you know. I wanted it to sound like me talking to her.
Would you do the song for us?
You got it. Tiptoed in the room, I know you got to have your rest. She says, come lay beside me, I've been waiting since you left. She's sweet to me, must be the luckiest man alive. Did I tell you, baby, you are the joy of my life? First time that I saw you, ooh, you took my breath away. I might not get to heaven, but I walk with the angels that day. She takes me by the hand, I am the luckiest man alive. Did I tell you, baby, all the joy of my life? Some may have the riches, some may have the worldly fame, as long as I have you, I'll treasure each and every day. Just take me by the hand, I am the luckiest man alive. And did I tell you, baby, you are the joy of my life?
It's John Fogerty playing in our studio a song that's on his new CD, Premonition, and that is also on his previous CD, Blue Moon Swamp. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more, and maybe you can play some more music for us. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Fogerty, who's joining us in the studio with his guitar. And he has a new CD called Premonition, in which he performs a lot of the songs that he wrote in the Creedence Clearwater days. And we are actually, this time around, he joined us recently on Fresh Air, and we talked about those songs. This time around, we're also focusing on some of the songs he wrote since the Creedence Clearwater revival era. And let me ask you to do one of those songs, John. And this is called Hot Rod Heart. And is this a great... It's a lively, spirited song. Tell us about writing this.
Well, of course, historically, one of the parts of rock and roll music has been the drive-in song or car song. And I'd always wanted to write a song like that. In fact, I had the title Hot Rod Heart for several years, really, without having a song to go with it. And I had tried it many times and failed before. I mean, this is just the process if you're a songwriter. And one day, though, when I came up with the intro, the, you know, ooh, let's go riding, right? And what would follow that? Rolling down the open road. Okay, that's pretty generic. Let's go riding, cruising down the open road. And then when I came up with, we can put the top down, listen to the radio, I thought, oh, okay, that's like got a personality. There's a place I seem to be going with that. And the rest of it came pretty quickly after that.
Would you play it for us?
I'll do my best here.
Ooh, let's go riding, cruising down an open road. We can put the top down, listen to the radio. Big old Buick in a big old sky, the wheels on fire, and I tell you why. Got a hot rod heart. Ooh, let's go prowling, sneaking like we used to do. Way back in the country, cut across the cornfields too. Big old Harley and a big old move. Big old Gainer putting on the Zoom. I got a hot rod heart. Got a one-way ticket to the open road, come on. Got a red line engine and I'm ready to go. Put the pedal to the metal if you want to ride. If you want to ride, let's go.
That's great. A great car song. And so tell me, were cars important to you growing up in El Cerrito, California, which was near Berkeley?
To any kid, they're important. I really never had a cool car. My first car was a 1948 Ford that was in prime condition when I got it, actually. But I didn't, you know, it was an old man's car. I really never had the cool car till I was probably 19 or 20. I got a 57 Chevy hardtop, and that was, like, considered pretty, you know, it was red and white, and that was, like, a classic. I wish I still had it. They're worth a lot of money now.
There's all these stories about how the early rock producers like Phil Spector would do mixes of records so that they'd sound good on radio speakers, because that's where the teenagers were listening, on car radios and little radios at home. Did you care about things like that when you started making records? Did you want it to sound right on a car speaker?
I would say it's beyond that. I would say it's only that. I mean, it to me, it's like elements of the universe. I'm serious. It's, you know, there's the sun and there's the moon and then there's a car speaker. I make all my records. That's all I'm looking for, that it sound good in a car. And I believe that part of the reason, especially my old Creedence records, part of the reason they still sound so good now, especially in a car, is because I was paying, as a producer, I was paying very much attention to that. You know, a big symphonic arrangement is not going to sound very good in a car, really. It's too busy. Or a big movie score. There's just, you know, there's 150 instruments going on. And as a kid, as a listener, and then finally when I was really getting it right during the Creedence time as a producer, basically it's a mid-range thing. The human voice and then a backbeat. That's rock and roll. If you can squeeze in anything else to get the beat propelled forward, meaning the bass drum, that's good. But mainly you need that vocal. Everyone identifies with the voice and then the backbeat. And the electric guitar happens to be right in the same range as the voice. So those things are the most important. And that's the way I mixed Creedence records, and I'm still mixing my records now that way. You kind of feature those things. And it was a good lesson to learn, I believe, because the, you know, my old records still sound pretty good in a car, especially.
John Fogerty, he'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Fogerty, who brought his guitar to our studio to perform a few songs. His latest CD, Premonition, is a live recording featuring many of his old songs from his Creedence Clearwater days, as well as some recent songs. Before Fogerty performs another song for us, let's listen to an early pre-Creedence recording when his record company named the band the Gollywogs, a name Fogerty hated. This track, Fight Fire, is featured on a forthcoming Rhino Records box set that is an expanded version of the classic garage rock anthology Nuggets. Here's the Gollywogs. John Fogerty, that's you from the mid-1960s. Were you in on the production of that recording?
Kind of yes and no. We were on, you know, the little label that Fantasy Records recorded us in a little lean-to in the back of their offices, you might say. And they were ashamed of us in a sense. It was not on the Fantasy label. It was on Scorpio in an attempt, I guess, to look hipper or more rockin' or something. The man in charge at that point was a guy named Max Weiss, who was, I guess, you know, we learned something while we were going through this process. So in the long run, it's a good thing. But I don't think Max, you know, these were jazz people. And you just go along. You write your songs, you get your arrangements, you come in and you hope they can kind of capture what you're doing on tape. I think what I'm trying to say is I didn't know how to do it much better at that point, but I was sure paying attention to try and learn how to do it. Because frankly, that record there, it's actually a pretty good arrangement and a pretty good song for mid-65 rock and roll pop music. But it doesn't sound very good, I must say. It's kind of, you know, sounds like a garage band. It's in a great place now, I suppose.
Your voice is much higher on that, isn't it?
Thinner, I would say.
Yeah.
I'm singing along. There's no overdubs that I remember. I'm singing along with my brother Tom. It's two voices in unison or in harmony there. During this period of time, by the way, I used to joke with the band. I'd say, well, I guess Phil Spector isn't going to come down here and produce us, so I'm going to have to learn how to do this myself. And it was especially on hearing these records back, that I thought there was some really good stuff there, but they didn't sound very good, and we were going to have a hard time getting our records played. I later met Phil Spector, by the way.
Did you?
I've told him that little story because, you know, he's at that point was the world's greatest producer, and probably what we lacked most at this point was having a producer.
We talk a little bit about your guitar sound and the influence of Sun Records on you. Who really inspired your singing the most, would you say? Who influenced you the most as a singer?
Little Richard first. And then Otis Redding. Not that I sound anything like Otis, but he had such great command of what he did with his voice. I mean, it really wasn't one of those remarkable voices like say Paul McCartney or Elvis Presley, but Otis got his, you know, maximum money's worth out of his voice, all kinds of soul and emotion, and I really paid attention to that. Paul McCartney was another big influence, of course. Carl Perkins, probably even more than Elvis. Carl was the king rockabilly guy. I mean, those early records, which we take for granted now, like Honey Don't and Boppin' the Blues, there's some great singing and playing there.
Do you play those yourself?
Yeah, I still do when I'm sitting around having fun.
Would you do a few bars of one of those? Or?
Oh, gee, well. Well, it's a 1 for the money and 2 for the show. A 3 to get ready, now go, cat, go. But don't you step on my blue suede shoe. You can do anything when they hop for them blue suede shoes. You can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Do anything that you wanna do. Honey, lay hop of them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay hop of them blue suede shoes.
That was wonderful.
Thank
you for doing that. John Fogerty is my guest. The last time we were on the show, we talked a little bit about your vowels, your pronunciation, your very Southern almost pronunciation on some songs. And it wasn't until after you'd left the interview that I noticed that on Bad Moon Rising, I think it's on the last chorus of it, you sing, "There's a bathroom on the right," instead of "There's a bad moon on the rise." And I think there's a whole book of misinterpreted lyrics, as people mishear them, and that's one of the lyrics that's talked about in that book. How did you find out that people were mishearing the lyric as "there's a bathroom on the right" instead of "there's a bad moon on the rise"?
Probably, I never heard this while Creedence was together as a band, you know. So for me, there's sort of a cut and dry period. Creedence broke up in 72, and I left showbiz somewhere quickly after that, meaning I... having been on the top rung of the ladder or in the top levels of showbiz, I quickly escaped to the bottom rung of the ladder just to get away, you know. And somewhere in the mid-70s, I would do, you know, I'd sing at somebody's wedding or I'd play at a party, I'd get up and do a song or two, and someone would come up to me and say, "In Bad Moon Rising, do you say there's a bathroom on the right?" I began hearing that story, because it didn't occur to me. I didn't know I was part of one of those trivia things, like "excuse me while I kiss this guy," you know, those things.
So has it made you self-conscious about how you sing it now, knowing that people were mishearing it?
No, I sing it on purpose now.
But when you're not singing it that way on purpose, when you're just singing "There's a Bad Moon on the Rise," are you more self-conscious about how you say it?
No. No, I just, it's one of those deals that you become connected to. You know, it's like a game within a game, sort of. Another one, I know somebody thought I was saying, "Have you ever seen Lorraine?" You know, put it this way. Bruce Springsteen is a friend of mine, and yet every time I'm around, I forget to ask him, "In that song, Blinded by the Light, just what the heck are you saying? You know, wrapped up in the moon of light." I don't have a clue what's going on there. I'd really like to know someday.
My guest is John Fogerty. He has a new CD called Premonition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Fogerty, the former leader of Creedence Clearwater Revival. Getting back to your voice and the influences on it, the record before your current record, Blue Moon Swamp, is a very Southern record, and I think you spent a lot of time in the South and visited Robert Johnson's grave there. Would you say that any of the, say, Mississippi blues singers influenced your approach to singing?
Howlin' Wolf particularly, yeah.
He has a real rumbly...
Well, he does that growl. It's almost like guitar players have a thing called a fuzz tone or a distortion box, you know. And Howlin' Wolf had that in his voice. He really remarkably had it more than any other singer that I was aware of at the time I was growing up. So songs like "Smokestack Lightning," "Wang Dang Doodle," you know, I mean, there was just this spooky thing in his voice. So he influenced me a lot to try and do that. Now, obviously, something so affected, whenever you do it, people are going to refer to your influence. They're going to know who you're doing because it's so unusual. But a funny thing about Howlin's when I started going down to Mississippi, I started reading about and hearing about a guy named Charlie Patton, who I hadn't heard in my lifetime. I'm ashamed to say I didn't know his music. And I, of course, was reading about him, and I finally even kind of discovered where he's buried, you know, through all the local lore and stuff. When I finally got a hold of one of his records, it was a cassette, actually, you know, I was surprised they had his records. I thought maybe it was more like the Dead Sea Scrolls or something, you know. And it, when I put it on and heard his voice, I went, oh, my God, that's the father of Howlin' Wolf. I mean, it's that same thing. It just, it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Charlie lived at Dockery's Plantation. Howlin' Wolf lived at Dockery's Plantation, was quite a bit younger than Charlie. So he sort of passed on the lamp, you might say. And a little bit of that went into me at a, you know, a long time ago.
Now, did you find you had to be careful with that growly sound because you can really hurt your vocal cords?
That's my favorite thing to do, is hurt my vocal cords. I can remember, it's funny, I don't worry about it. I guess you do got to be careful. I find that you do more damage when you're on stage and you can't hear yourself very well. So you start, because the monitors aren't right, okay? And you start shouting to overcome the band, and you make it sort of work, but in your youthful exuberance, you blow out your voice. I have learned now to step back and go, wait, whoa. Tell them to turn up the speaker. Don't try to overcome the band by singing, you know, louder than all that amplification. Because I, in the years past, would definitely blow out my voice doing that.
Your voice has maintained itself really well.
It's kind of the rope-a-dope, the Muhammad Ali thing. I think perhaps all not being out on the road in some whiskey-soaked tavern, smoke-filled barroom, you know, and screaming above all the drunks for years and years maybe saved my voice a little. But I will say that it's kind of like calluses or building muscles. My voice is usually a little stronger at the end of a tour rather than weaker. It just sort of bounces back. You know, it's during the time off that it kind of loses some of that strength.
Well, I'd love to ask you to do one more song for us. And what would you like to do?
I guess I could do Have You Ever Seen Lorraine? Someone told me long ago, there's a calm before the storm. I know, been that way for all my time. When it's over, so they say, it'll rain a sunny day. I know, shining down like water. Have you ever seen the rain? I want to know. Have you ever seen the rain? Coming down a sunny day. Yeah. I want to know. Have you ever seen the rain? Have you ever seen the rain coming down a sunny day?
That was wonderful. I can't let you go without the story behind the song.
Actually, this song is about the breakup of my band, Creedence Clearwater Revival. It seemed like, if I can say this without too much cynicism or old feelings of bitterness, it seemed like we had achieved everything we set out to do, or at least I felt that way. And yet, at the height of our success, it just seemed like the people around me kept inventing problems. So, my way of expressing that musically was to say, have you ever seen the rain coming down on a sunny day. Here we had our beautiful golden sunny day that we had strived for all our lives, and now everybody's, you know, being negative and going, this isn't right, that isn't right, my hotel room isn't large enough, or, you know, what. There's so many things. If you perceive your cup as half empty, there's so many things to complain about all the time. Again, since I was the leader of the band and the manager and all the rest, I was the focus of all that complaining, I guess. So I thought I said it very well. I said it mysteriously, I suppose. I think one of my lines is, through the circle fast and slow, and it can't stop, I wonder. Because it seemed like we were doomed. The more success I would create for the band, the larger the jealousy and infighting got. Therefore, the harder it got for me. You know, it's like the better I did it, the more success, the more gold records, the more songs, and even, let's say, the higher the quality got in the music, it just seemed like the troubles got bigger in a sort of logarithmic answer to it. So, and you know what? I mean, looking back, we're not unusual. It happens all the time that way.
What's different for you touring now?
I try to enjoy it more. I really didn't enjoy it that much then. I mean, when you're really young, you don't know. You just think you're going to live forever. I mean, that's the first thing. And you just think you're made of steel. You know, everything's going to bounce off. And it pretty much does. But I tour with my family now. And I really am trying to provide an experience for them, a loving environment. I was going to say something earlier in the song or around the song I wrote for Julie. It's something I firmly believe is the better I treat her, the better my life becomes. And we, now touring, we try to keep that thought together, at least in our own environment. Touring is logistically hard. You're moving everybody all across the country and out of a suitcase and all that sort of thing. So you need to at least keep your own relationship, the way your close-knit family is dealing with the universe. You need to protect that. You need to work on that relationship every day, all the time.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here in the studio, and thank you so much for performing some songs for us. I thoroughly enjoyed it and really appreciate it.
Thanks, Terry.
John Fogerty, his new CD, Premonition, is a live recording of a VH1 concert.